This week's conversation with Elizabeth Tapper of Lenham Needlecraft and the Art of the Needle is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Kim and the folks at Sassy Jack's are getting ready to open their new Forever Home in January. It'll be exciting to be able to visit the new store. In the meantime, be sure to check out sassyjackstitchery.com for the full collection of sassafras samplers charts, and Kim and Company are also now carrying the beautiful Cottage Garden threads, new designs from Ink Circles, including the Victorian licensed Cosmo Kit. When you're doing your holiday shopping, a great gift for your stitching friends is a Sassy Jack's gift certificate. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com and plan to visit the new shop when it opens in January. And now, on to our conversation with Liz Tapper of Lenham Needlecraft and the Art of the Needle. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, from Lenham Needlecraft and the Art of the Needle, Liz Tapper. Liz, welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Oh, glad to have you. So much to learn from you because you've done everything.
I wouldn't quite go that far.
Well, we're going to go that far. You've done everything. The list is long.
The list is long.
Yep.
There's still lots I want to do.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm jealous of what you've accomplished so far. So how's that? Yeah.
That would do.
All right. So a graduate of the Royal School, how do we, what's your journey to the Royal School?
I have to blame my mother and my grandmother for that.
Okay.
I did embroidery from a young age at home. My mum studied embroidery, needlework rather, at teacher training college in the 60s. And my nan has always enjoyed embroidery, but that was mainly cross stitch back then. And I don't know about over there, but here, when a child starts off with embroidery, it's normally on really low count Aida fabric,
mm-hmm.
a PLA, and a nice blunt needle. So that's what I started on. It was making little coasters for drinks, bookmarks. I've still got some of them floating around somewhere, actually. But yeah, that started me off. And then from there, I found out about some more techniques. So Mum and I went to a few adult education classes at the local centre. And that's when I dabbled a bit in black work and gold work. And then we also went on a lovely embroidery holiday to France for a week, I believe, when I was about 18. And we visited the Bayeux Tapestry. And then we came back to where we were staying in the group. And we all made a replica of the Bayeux horse, or one of the Bayeux horses, in laid work. And all of those bits and pieces that I'd done all formed part of my portfolio for when I applied to join the apprenticeship at the Royal School of Needlework.
So your mom was the ultimate enabler then. That's great.
Absolutely. I mean, this was really before, you know, the internet took off. So it wasn't easy to find out about these different things. So I don't know how she managed to find out about the RSN, the Royal School, but she did. And after doing my A-levels at school, that's from age 16 to 18, lots of people go on to university, and I was a bit interested in university, but I was definitely more grabbed by textiles. And I think Mum had done her own research and found out about the RSN. And it went from there, really. I had an interview with the principal at the time, Liz Elvin, who's still around. And I amazingly was accepted as one of six apprentices. And then it all began.
Now, so all through school, I mean, it's fascinating to me because you start as a kid, and then as a teenager and into your early 20s, you know, there's invariably some junctures in there where the needlework is a backseat to boys and parties and homework and all those things. Did the stitching stay with you all the way through, or did you have gaps where you just gave it a break?
It stayed with me in a kind of low-level capacity, I'd say, all the way through. When I got to secondary school, the needlework teacher had just come back from being retrained from doing needlework to doing something called craft design and technology, which basically meant that rather than doing needlework at school, instead you were bending pieces of perspex to make pencil holders, or you were planing bits of wood and sticking them together to make cars. It was completely different. So instead I used to do my embroidery at home, kind of at the weekend or occasional evenings when I'd finished my homework. And yeah, that's where I snuck it in, really. Even with boys on the horizon, I still found a bit of time for embroidery.
Now, Beth, your needlework teacher in school, what did you learn? Yeah, right.
We didn't do any needlework in school. That's it. You know, basic cooking, but you know, U.S. doesn't teach those things. Doesn't teach needlework at school, unless they do an extracurricular, unless somebody comes in. So that's kind of interesting that still in the UK they have those, that they offer it at all.
You mean offer through the RSN?
No, the that in your, is it in your secondary classes?
No, they offer. It wasn't in mine because she just retrained from doing needlework. It loosely is present in school under textiles, but textiles can take the form of anything. So it could be sheets of metal, it could be wood, it can be man-made fibers, anything. My daughter, she's just started her GCSEs, and we were looking at the GCSE in textiles, and it was nothing like what we thought, so she's not actually doing it. And it's a shame. There's so little provision for people who enjoy embroidery and textiles when you're school age nowadays here. You know, when my mum was at school, and my nan, they did dressmaking, for example, and then they would embellish what they made with stitches. But no, there's nothing like that, not in school.
Yeah, that's essentially been eliminated here too. And I mean, my whole orientation was science all the way through school, but I still remember in eighth grade, the half semester we had that was cooking and sewing, and I forget what the third thing was, but you know, just valuable life skills that you just don't get unless, you know, I mean, your parents apparently, I mean, should show you some of those things, but still there's getting those in school. And then, yeah, you wonder how many people would end up on a path like yours if they had been given that exposure. Of course, you had the advantage of your mother, but you know, in a school setting to be able to experience some of that. And it gets lost, I think. And I think there's a good number of kids that would have chosen different paths if they'd had it.
Absolutely. I mean, when the apprenticeship was running at the RSN, as I said before, they only took on about 6 students a year. So there weren't many anyway doing it. And they were mainly female. But I think nowadays the interest is more towards fashion. Mm-hmm. And how embroidery and fabric embellishment can be applied to fashion. So actually learning the traditional hand embroidery techniques is, well, clearly not as popular as it used to be years ago. But yeah. It's still, you know, there's still a core of people who who are interested by it. And I think it just, that core of people, just keep it, you know, humming along in the background. And then fashion, as in not clothes fashion, but the trends of ages, they will rise and fall, and it'll come back into fashion hopefully, and then it might fall away again. I've noticed that with certain techniques, particularly things like Mount Melick in white work, that had a revival a few years ago. Gold work's very popular currently, and that's been so for a few years now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Royal School, I give them credit all day long for really, I think, staying at the front edge of needlework and making it available and teaching it. And really, I think, have done a tremendous job of moving it forward rather than just sitting there as a aged institution and, you know, and not really doing anything. I mean, that the stitch bank they have, and the classes online and in the States. I mean, there's just so much they're doing to further the cause, and you really give them a lot of credit for that.
Absolutely. And I think COVID actually helped with that.
Yeah.
You know, they suddenly had to go online because otherwise there was nothing coming in. So they put lots of classes online, and they do the online talks, which I find really interesting as well. And they've, you know, apart from COVID, they have so many classes nowadays. They have the certificate and diploma, they have the day classes, they have the future tutors who were the equivalent, who are the equivalent to the apprenticeship students, and they have the degree students as well. Mm-hmm. So much going on.
Yeah.
Oh, there's something.
Yeah, they're just outreach all over the place. It's really really admirable.
Yes.
and it's nice that it's any level. I think sometimes we tend to think, oh, the Royal School of Needlework, it's above what I can do. But I really think they offer something for anybody. You know, you can be a beginner, a ranked beginner, and take an online class. Just make sure you're signed up for the right one.
I had a
bunch of, took the, I think the B one, the gold work, I think it was the gold work B came on like a year ago. And some of them had never done gold work before, and they said it was a fabulous class, just great way to learn how to do a technique that they wanted to try.
It's so nice to hear that kind of thing, you know, that someone has really enjoyed a class, because, and regardless of their skill level, because, you know, a class might say beginners or advanced, but ultimately the tutor can bend the tuition to the student, you know, regardless of what skill level the actual class is.
Yeah. One thing in all of the RSN people that we've talked to that's become quite clear is once you go through one of their intense programs and come out of it with a certificate, diploma, whatever it is, the one thing that you learn above all else is whether you really love needle and thread and embroidery and needlework in general, because those are pretty intense things. And from all the descriptions, almost around the clock needlework for a long time.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm mentally reliving that period right now. Yes, it was so busy. I mean, I was 18 when I started my apprenticeship, and it was 3 years. And of the six, four of us finished the course, two dropped out because they found it just wasn't for them. But your timetable basically would have you working on three things at the same time at different stages. So one would be in the design stage, all different techniques. So you might have black work in the design stage. You might have gold work currently on the slate frame being worked on. And then you might have canvas shading being mounted. Plus you've got all the notes, all the research, and how to notes to do for every technique, plus illustrations, stitch guides, thread samples, so much, plus plus exhibiting and demonstrating at like Alexandra Palace, the knitting and stitching shows at Olympia. And when all the university students were on holiday, we would go down to what was then called the workroom, so it's now the studio, and we would work on various commissions that had come in, and that could range from repairing a sampler, reweaving an old tapestry hanging, to stitching something entirely new, like the ecclesiastical vestments for Wells Cathedral, just down the road from me. Somehow, I still managed to find time for boys. Not quite sure how.
Well, you're young then.
I know, I think I just needed less sleep in those days. But I do remember staying up late, or too late, on several occasions. One occasion I invented my own stitch, which had to be unpicked. And another time I was working on something called tapestry shading, which is where all the stitches have to be in a vertical orientation. And the bits I worked on and was very pleased with that night, I looked up the next morning and it wasn't vertical, it was following the angle, so again I had to unpick it. So yeah, the moral of that story is, don't get involved with boys, don't stay up late, just work hard.
Oh, those boys, they can really take you down the wrong path, huh?
Absolutely, yes.
Sorry, Gary.
Yeah, it's all right. I'm getting used to it. Yeah, it's okay. But it just, it's so cool because, you know, when you just described all of that, what a tremendous broad exposure you get to all aspects and come out of there. I mean, you really come out of that with a full knowledge of needlework, you know, regardless of what your skill level's at. And I'm sure by the time you're done, it's quite high. But just your exposure alone is so valuable.
It is, and you're introduced to so many different techniques. But I think the more that you learn, the more you realise how many other techniques are out there that you don't know anything about. You know, in the world, every country has its own special techniques, and they're all wonderful. And we only know, really, a few of them. Mm-hmm. You know, the RSN does teach you a lot. And you learn at least five different white work techniques among others. Again, you know, even white work, there's so many different types.
So did you have a favorite technique that you learned while you were there?
My favorite technique, I think it was a silk shading at the time. So I did a silk shaded snowdrop for my first piece. And I did, for my second year, I did the tapestry shaded saint. So we all had to do a cross, a saint, and an animal in our second year at that time. So a tapestry shaded saint, and then a peregrine falcon. Mm. And then since then, I've done a few other birds, actually. I was commissioned to do a pair of buzzards on a piano stool. And I did a long-tailed tit for my husband's birthday last year in lockdown. But it's a lovely technique to do. It's very fine, just using one strand of a stranded cotton.
Do you find it relaxing?
I do, yes. I think the bit I don't find relaxing is getting everything together and actually finding the time to do it. Because although I am trained as an embroiderer, I don't have a lot of time actually to spend embroidering. It's all, there's lots of admin.
Yeah.
There's lots of, you know, designing for kits. Mainly the embroidery I get to do these days is when I've designed a kit, I then stitch it. And I photograph it comprehensively and I write the instructions up. And that's, I suppose, my stitching downtime. But stitching for myself doesn't happen.
Yeah.
The only stitching I do for myself is making curtains and blinds on the sewing machine, which does not count.
No. Well, I mean, I think anyone who has a business in needlework would tell that same story, that to be able to sit down and just stitch for pure enjoyment, you know, the opportunities are just so small because there's always something that needs to be done to get the next kid out, or, you know, basic paperwork and financial things. It just, it takes a lot of time.
It does. And I think a lot of people don't realize that when they set up a business in embroidery.
Yeah.
That it's going to take that much of your time. So in working on commissions is another way that I spend time embroidering. And that's nice. And that's varied as well. But, you know, that can be anything.
Yeah, that's a fascinating world, and you apparently do a lot of it. What is that like in terms of, because you've got a customer and you're creating a piece of art for them instead of a piece of art for you. There's got to be a lot of early work involved to understand what they're after, and then your own interpretation, and then whether you like it or not, you got to plow through and get it done.
I've always liked what I've done. But there is lots of prep beforehand. Yes, you have to figure out what the customer wants. Then you have to do lots of research. You have to make it embroiderable, as if that's a word, because lots of images don't necessarily translate into particular embroidery techniques very well. You need to adapt them. And then you need to choose obviously all the colours and again the technique. It might not necessarily be silk shading, it could be anything. But I think I've always designed things that I just ultimately like, and it seems to fit in with what my customer likes. So I suppose because they've seen my portfolio online, they know what my style is.
Yeah, I think if we lined up 10 people, we'd probably easily find half of them who want nothing to do with commissions. And then, you know, a range other than that. And because it's got to be, it's just a different way to go about needlework.
Yes, it's a less personal way, I suppose, because you're not doing it for yourself. You don't get to keep what you've just created, which sometimes is a shame.
Yes.
You know, those that I did on the piano stool, I was really happy with them. To start with, when I was at the designing stage, it was such a headache because they were so tiny, and the feathers were each individually stitched. And I was just thinking, oh my goodness, what have I done? But you just have to sit down and get your teeth into it, and then it all comes together. That's what I've always found, you know, particularly with big projects. It takes a lot longer to do the research, a lot longer to do the designing. But when you actually sit down, providing you've done all that back work, background work beforehand, it all comes together when you get to stitch.
And when you hand that over to the customer, that's got to be, I would guess, most times just really exciting to see them be pleased with the result.
Yes, definitely. Because I tend to send them photos of it in progress, just so I can show them I'm actually working on it. I'm not just sat here. But also so that if there's anything they're not happy with, they can let me know while it's still in the embroidering stage.
Yeah.
But no, they've all been happy. And I also have to be happy with it. If I'm not happy with it, then it's not finished.
Yeah. That's... I don't think I'd have the courage to do that, but...
You might be surprised.
Yeah?
Yeah, baby steps.
Okay. I'll put it on the list.
So how did you get the Napoleonic coat commission? I that was just a beautiful gold work piece that I saw the little BBC video that was interviewed that was taped.
Yes, I didn't know about anything about it until my client actually contacted me, and I think he had just Googled goldwork embroidery on the internet, and my website came up. He had a look and got in contact, and it went from there. It was it's a multinational project that's actually still in progress. So he's British. He lives in Italy. I obviously live in England. The threads are made in England. It's being shipped to Pakistan for the actual embroidery part of it, though I'd done all the design work and the sourcing of materials. And then it was going back to Italy for him to put together the dressmaking. And then it was going off to France for one of the Napoleonic reenactments there at one of the chateaus in Paris.
So tell the story of that from the beginning, though. It's a coat, a replica of a coat that Napoleon wore?
Not quite. It's a military, a military dress coat.
Okay.
Of one of the aides-de-camps of Napoleon I. So basically one of his officers, it's the coat that person would have worn for all the posh occasions at court.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, I think, one original coat, I think, in a museum in Italy. And using that and lots of old drawings of designs that the embroiderers used to use at the time, that's what helped put it all together. But it's very detailed, and very, as it's military, it's very, has to be very exact.
Mm-hmm. So the purpose, who wanted this coat, and was it for reenactments?
Yes. Yeah, so my clients
you don't have to name names, but it was somebody who wanted it for reenactment things.
Yes, absolutely. Totally for himself. He wanted to outshine the women at court in these reenactments. Because they have lots of
men, you know.
Yes, so he wanted it for these reenactments. He said he'd had some done in the past, but the quality wasn't as good. So he wanted to really go all out this time.
Mm.
So it should have been all done for this weekend, actually. There's a reenactment happening at the Chateau Malmaison in Paris this weekend. And he was meant to be wearing it there. But unfortunately, the postal service in Italy messed up, rather.
Oh.
And it didn't appear when it should have appeared. And so we missed the slot with the studio in Pakistan, and he didn't then have enough time to make it up. So it still needs to be embroidered. It still needs to be made up, and he still needs to outbling the women.
Oh, yeah. and I found it fascinating that it, you know, you had to be so precise on that uniform, because it, depending on the ranking, made a difference in the amount of gold work, correct?
Yes, I believe the higher ranking had deeper gold work on the collar. I'm not sure where else. I didn't research the different structures of the military for that. But yes, it did have to be very exact, and it had to have oak leaves, it had to have acorns and acorn cups, and it had to have this particular border of two types of gold work all the way around, and all measured, you know, as I said in that clip on the BBC, with millimetres. Hmm. So it was lots of using the ruler, lots of counting, and then lots of drawing and tracing, and yes. But it was really interesting to work on. And once they got into the flow of drawing the oak leaves and adding the acorns and things, it really came together. It was really nice to see.
So your role was to draw out and plan out all of the embroidery?
Yes, yeah, so my role was to, using all those historical references, design it. I'd been given the paper dressmaking patterns. So I had the actual sizing.
Oh, okay.
So I had that. That was, I had to have that really so that it was exactly correct. So I put the used tracing paper, traced out the sizes of the dressmaking patterns, and then using those, I allocated the areas where the embroidery needed to fit in, and then went from there really. So that's when I started drawing the leaves on and the acorns, and each because it's a coat, it's got two sides, so each side, one was the reverse of the other. The same with the cuffs,
yeah,
and the reverse as well. So there's several pieces that all make it up.
And then, but now the actual coat making, the cloth of the coat, that's what happened in Pakistan.
The actual embroidery, the gold work of the coat, is what will happen in Pakistan.
Okay.
It's not there yet. Hopefully, all the metal threads and the samples that I've stitched and all my instructions are hopefully in a car traveling from England to Italy, no, France, actually, as we speak. I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that's
what... I was going to say, a little nervous here, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And then it needs to go to Pakistan, and then it'll be stitched, and I'll be working as a consultant on that, checking the quality of their gold work.
And this may be out of line here, but why aren't you doing the gold work?
Because it's cheaper to have it done in Pakistan. But also they there are more of them. There's just me here. And it would take me a long, long time, and they can do it far more quickly because they have more people.
Okay.
But primarily I think it's down to cost.
Time and money. Time and money.
Absolutely.
Every time.
Yeah.
But then, as they're doing it, they'll be sending you photos, and so you can check and guide them.
Yes, that's the idea. Yeah. Oh. Because the last thing that my client wants to happen is to have all this meticulous work done with the designing and sourcing the correct size materials and the samples for them to just go off on their own whim and ruin it. So yes, we'll be following them avidly.
Now, materials for something like that, sourcing all those and getting enough, a challenge these days? I mean, it's so hard for people to get materials these days.
Well, the gold threads come from a company. They used to be called Benton & Johnson, and they're based in England. They're now part of another company called Toy Kenning and Spence, based in the Midlands, I think, middle of the country. And they are now the only producer of gold thread in this country. There was another one who actually started up from leaving Benton & Johnson. He started up on his own, and then he retired after about 15 years. I think the person who's taken it over isn't doing very well in terms of producing the threads.
Oh.
So it's just down to them now, and they are snowed under. But I think there's only four of them in that workshop producing the metal threads.
Oh.
And it's quite an involved process. There are so many different types.
Yeah.
So there's a training element too. But the quantity of the threads, when I did my sample, I had to figure out how much I'd used of each particular thread for a leaf, for an acorn, for half an acorn, for a length of stem, for a section of border. And then I had to count the number of leaves. I had to measure all the border. And then I had to work out how much thread I needed from that.
Oh, Liz. Oh, man.
And then I had to add a bit more for mistakes and unpickings. Yes. It was quite a big order.
No kidding. Well, that's disappointing that we're down to one British company, England, British making quality gold work threads. Oh, boy.
I know. I mean, I hope that the other person just gets it together and manages to, you know, make it successful. It was certainly, you know, successful before then.
Yeah.
But it is quite, I think, quite a steep learning curve. Maybe they've taken on a bit more than they can currently deal with. I don't know. Don't really know the story behind that. But yes, so I just hope that they, you know, Benton Johnson, Toy Kenning and Spence, they carry on. Because there's certainly demand there.
Right.
You know, if you put an order in, it's easily about 3 months before you get it.
Mm.
So, you know, that was another thing I had to consider with ordering the metal threads for the coat. I contacted the man in charge there and said, I've got a really urgent order. Can you help me? And they did it in a month, which was amazing.
Oh.
They had a lovely box of biscuits. I sent them for the thank you.
Hey, whatever works, right?
Absolutely. You know? Yes, yes.
Wow, what a project. Holy smokes.
I know. You don't get many like that around.
No. No, and still ongoing, so you're still on pins and needles a bit about it happening.
I know. I just want to hear that it's finally with my client.
Yeah.
Relax a bit then.
Yep. Oh, boy. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on things to see how that comes out. I'm sure you'll be able to post photos at some point. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to that.
Yep. The other one is lampshades.
Yes.
Stitching lampshades. Talk to us about that, because that does not look easy.
Well, you don't do it in situ.
That's good
to
hear.
That's the main point. I think they just came about because I wanted to do something different that wasn't another picture for the wall. And I just thought, well, if I stitch a lampshade, it'll look really pretty when the light comes through. And at the same time, there was a company that had recently put together their own kits for how to make a lampshade. And back then this was maybe 8 years ago. They were just the basic drum shape lampshades. And so I started off with those and I just measured out the fabric that I needed, the size, and then I just designed it from there. And I decided to do it in the colours of the seasons. So I have spring, summer, autumn and winter. And and then once I'd stitched it, I just made it up into lampshade. And they've been popular as kits and also for me to stitch for people in different shapes, actually, as well. So I've done the drum shapes, obviously, and I've done a few other more unusual shapes. But they've all been really fun. They're nice to do. I like adding, there's a little snail I add. And whenever I stitch ones for people, I always put the snail in a different place. So they're all a bit different.
Okay, because Beth wants to make 10, so.
Well, I would allow at least 3 weeks for each one.
Oh, yeah, no. More than that. I'm slower than that. And what intrigued me about them is that, you know, you're right. After a while, you get tired of, okay, I can frame this. I can make it into a pillow. Now what do I do? And I love to stitch. And when I saw the lampshades, I thought, well, there's something you would look at it every day. You would see it. It would get used. And you have your needlework there. It's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope that the making up of the lampshade after you've stitched it isn't too daunting for people. The instructions are quite clear. And I've added a bit to the instructions that come with the lampshade kit rather than the embroidery bit. Just to make it extra clear for everyone. But that I can imagine that would be quite nerve-wracking for people.
Yeah, see, that's where I can see, all right, you just have a piece of cloth and you stitch it in the normal way on a frame or whatever you use. But then, yeah, that's where I would run into the freaking out stage is, all right, now I got to put this on a lampshade frame. So do you provide the frame?
Yes, it's all provided. So I provide the embroidery side of the kit. So all the instructions, the fabric, the threads, all of that. And then I source the lampshade kit from a different company. So that's included in the kit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that comes with all the bits that you need to make up a rigid lampshade.
There's a key word right there, because I could see my lampshade and it wouldn't be particularly rigid. I can see wrinkles and twists and all kinds of things.
It's a bit, the lining is quite rigid that you stick the fabric to.
Oh, okay.
So it has like a sticky grid paper on it. And so you can line it all up quite easily and just weight it down. That's the trick, really. Use lots of paperweights so that it doesn't roll up. Your fabric's nice and flat. And just do it slowly. There's no rush. And you can, if you do find that there's an air bubble or something, you can just unstick it a bit and then stick it down again.
So what do you use for the fabric? Is that just normal?
It's linen twill. So it's the traditional Jacobean fabric. It has a slight diagonal grain on it. And I'm only using that one because it is the traditional fabric. You can use anything really that's quite tightly woven. Needs to be a heavyweight fabric, though, to support the stitches.
So have you thought about doing a white work one?
I have actually done a white work one. I've got one that I've made up, not as a kit. It's a pulled thread lampshade. I think it's on my website. I can't remember. But it's quite expensive, so no one's bought it. But it's very pretty. It's on like a natural coloured even weave linen with white thread for the stitching, and it's lots of different ivy leaves with the stems and tendrils in a really fine leather cord that's couched down, and that looks really effective when the light's on because the light comes through the pulled thread leaves even more than the actual fabric, so it creates all these little patterns.
Beth, let's go. Let's go, Beth.
I need another project.
Yeah. Yeah, let's go. I think so. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I think white work on white fabric for a lampshade, I think would just get too dusty.
Yes. At my house with the cat, it would.
Yes. Yeah, cats are a bit annoying sometimes.
Okay, there you go, Beth. There's your next project right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll watch.
I knew you were going to say that.
The other thing in your designs are the mosaics, the needlepoint mosaics. The history behind those just fascinates me.
Yes, I mean, there are. I think with those mosaics, they were discovered and then they were covered back over, which just sounds bizarre. But apparently it was the best way of protecting them. And they were designed by a customer of mine who buys my Appleton's wool. And she wanted to design these cushions, and she was really interested in the Roman mosaics. And so I think she has four. I chose a couple for my website. And, yeah, they're really effective, just the repeating pattern. But just the history, I think the history, because they're all mosaics discovered in the UK, I believe. Fishburne, and I can't remember what the other ones were. But they're lovely.
And they're all Roman tile design, then?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so neat. Because there was something not too long ago where they'd found some in some farmer's field. It looked like it was 6 feet down that they found tile floor that was essentially intact, and that was my first thought was, wow, get that pattern. Yeah,
I know I saw something on the news about a farmer, was it in Syria, I can't remember where, discovering one recently.
Yeah
they're out there, you just don't know where.
Well, the two that you have on your website are, I mean, it's really impressive stuff. Glad you're offering those, because they're really nice. Yep. So what is it? Did you start your business right out of the Royal School, or was there a period of trying things and then you decided to just do it yourself? How did you evolve into your business?
I graduated in 98, so a while ago. And I know you mentioned earlier how the course at the RSN, either you leave it loving the embroidery or you just can't bear it any longer. Actually, it can be a bit of both. So after graduating, I spent about a year and a half, I think, teaching embroidery, working for the RSN, doing commissions. And then I just got a bit worn out. It was, you know, this was the days before the internet was, you know, so widely used. And it was hard to spread the word. It was hard to get commissions. Even it was hard to get paid. And it was all just hard. And I was 21 and I'd had enough. So I actually became a PA, a personal assistant, in an office. Uh-huh. And I did that for 10 years. I still did a bit of embroidery at home. But it was actually that break was quite nice. And in the end, I found that my fingers are starting to feel itchy in a I must start stitching kind of a way. And that's when I started getting back into it again. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Art of the Needle was founded. And that was really to do with teaching and kits and commissions. And then that ran for a few years. And then Lenham Needlecraft came up for sale. And I took that one on as well. I had actually been a customer of Lenham's myself. And the lady who ran it was a lovely old lady. And I always said to her, if you're thinking of selling, do let me know. And she did. And so I took that over about a year or year and a half before COVID hit. And that's kind of kept me going, really. You know, the orders come in all the time. And particularly during lockdowns, it was super busy.
Yeah.
Everyone was wanting to do something. And the amount of people who said, oh, I've just dug out this needlework kit from the back of the wardrobe. I think I haven't touched it for about 30 years. I need some wool. Can you help? So that was really good. Really good. You know, lots of people were saying, oh, I've got nothing to do. It's really boring. It's really quiet. I was like, I'm so busy. It doesn't stop. But, you know, that was really good. It was really good. Bit tiring at times. But yeah. It's really nice talking to all my customers as well. They're all so lovely because they're all like-minded.
Right.
And it's nice to chat about their projects and what they're up to and how long they've been doing it for. You know, I've got men and women from all walks of life, all ages, across the world, actually, who all, you know, use Appleton's wool, tapestry or crawl. And they have all these wonderful projects on the go. But it's just lovely to chat to them and see what they're up to.
Now, when you bought Lenham, did she have a physical store?
No. She was more of the kind of catalogue.
Okay.
Type. She had a website, but it was very clunky. I took that over and I completely redid the website, made it much more user friendly, and moved most of the customers over to online ordering.
Yeah.
There's still some who like to have an order form, you know, to fill in, or they call me up and order over the phone. And that's all fine, but it is quicker doing the orders on the website,
right,
and get more done that way. But yeah, so I took that over. I did the website, and then I merged the art and Lenham into one from being two. So Instagram, Pinterest, Facebook, Twitter, and also the website I merged a bit more too. So I started off with two individual websites, both selling products, and that became a bit expensive because you have to pay for the shop aspect.
Right.
So the needle is more like a a marker website, I would say now. You know, yeah, it has some information about me, but the link to the shop takes you to Lenham.
Yeah.
So I've kind of rejigged it that way.
And have you enjoyed doing that? I mean, interaction with customers has got to be a lot of fun, but especially during the pandemic, getting materials and getting them shipped to people is frustrating, I'm sure, at times. But you've enjoyed the retail end of things?
Yes, I have, actually. I have. I mean, just fulfilling an order is, well, very simple. But it's nice to know, particularly during lockdowns, when lots of my clients are older and perhaps live alone, that when they call you, they're calling because they need some wool, but also they could do with a really good chat too.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice to be able to provide that as well. And I learn stuff at the same time as well. So, you know, it benefits both of us.
Doing classes these days, you got you're busy on that end, things coming up?
It's busier now. We moved during lockdown and I couldn't offer.
Nice timing there.
I know. It was very stressful. I don't want to go there. when we moved, we didn't have internet, so we had to use hotspots on our phone, like I think Beth's using.
Right.
And I didn't have the internet capability to host a class online. I knew how to, but I couldn't actually do it. And obviously I couldn't do anything in person. So only fairly recently I've gone back to in-person classes. But I also am now able, having an internet connection that works, to offer online classes. So last weekend I was in Exeter in Devon in the southwest of England, and I was teaching Opus Anglicanum, which is a very ancient English technique, right, with silk floss and metal threads. And then beginning of November I've got an online course of 3 sessions on the goldwork coat. So it's a bit of a mix, but it's nice to have it like that. You know, you can, I've got someone coming in, calling in from America for the Zoom class,
right,
which, you know, is not so easy to do when you're not in the same country and you want to go to a class and, you know, it's in one country, you're in another. It's just not as practical. So COVID, again, has helped really open up online for people. You know, the talks and classes, there's lots to choose from.
Yeah, I was curious about your talks, too. Do you offer those on some kind of a schedule? Or are they something that if somebody requests?
It's more, yeah, as and when they're requested. So I have a couple, really, not very many, but I have one on myself, which sounds horribly conceited, but that's what people like to hear about.
Yeah.
And then I have another one coming up, actually, on Zoom in America, on the goldwork coat again. So, you know, that's something they particularly requested.
Yeah.
So I shall deliver.
When is that?
I think that is next year. So I've got a while.
She's got a while.
Yes. There's nothing like a deadline to motivate, I find.
Yes. So we'll be able to take that class and learn all about that coat then.
You'll have to join the waiting list, I'm afraid.
Oh, really? Already?
Yeah, it's fully booked.
Wow.
The November class, anyway. I don't know about the lecture. I think that's one of the guilds in America who asked me to do that. But yes, the goldwork coat course online is currently fully booked, but I have a waiting list and there are names on it already. So if I get enough interest, I will run it again.
Well, good for you.
They spread the word.
That's great. Yeah. Are you tutoring wise? Do you have a space where you can have people come to you, or do you go to them? How do you work with that?
People can come to me. I've got space here and good light. I run a regular monthly session, like for 2 hours, where people come with a range of embroidery techniques and have a chat and a coffee, and they just ask me for any help they need or any advice or fabrics or materials. And yeah, that's just a nice kind of chat along session, really. And then I haven't done it in this house, but in my last house, I did run some classes from home, like whole day classes. I think one was in gold work, one was making a brooch. So I will do that again. Again, it's just getting round to it, finding enough time in the day to organize everything.
Yeah.
Right. Sleep sometimes. That's the problem.
I know. And I need sleep.
It does help. It does help. Yeah.
It does. I'm quite grumpy otherwise.
Well, Liz, thanks so much. This is what a fascinating little journey you've had here.
It's been fun. It has been fun. Hard work, but fun and enjoyable.
Yep. Well, thanks for doing this, and thanks to everyone for listening.